Dr. Adam Harrison is a physician, lawyer, and leadership coach who brings a unique perspective to his varied services. His personal and professional experiences with workplace bullying fuel his mission to make leaders kinder and create psychologically safe workplaces for everyone. He joins us today from New Zealand. Adam, thank you so much for taking part in this conversation titled Navigating Workplace Bullying, Finding Resilience, and Feeling Joy Even in Crisis. How you doing, Adam?
Hey, hi, Andy. Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me along to your summit. I'm doing all right today. Thank you. Sun is shining here in New Zealand. Sky is blue.
So, looks gorgeous.
You know, no point in whinging. It's all good.
Okay, great. Well, against this beautiful background of yours, I have to ask you about some dark experiences that you had and obviously that your clients are having. So amazing background. You're a doctor and a lawyer, so we'll get into all of that. But despite your status and your accomplishments, you've been bullied at work multiple times and you've experienced burnout. Can you tell us a little bit about that, given your multiple degrees and your success in creating a wonderful profession for yourself?
Sure. Well, as you've alluded to, you know, having a kind of a decent academic background is not in any way a shield from these experiences. And in fact, you know, in some parts of the world, like Australia and New Zealand, if you are, you know, an accomplished person or what some people, you know, might perceive as an overachiever, that in itself can be a reason to be bullied. You know, I'm sure you've heard of tall poppy syndrome, but it's, you know, very, very rife down here in the Antipodes. But that didn't apply to me anyway.
Well, tell us about that real quick. What does that mean? What's that term mean?
Yes. So, you know, the tall poppy is the poppy that grows above the other poppies, you know, it's striving for the sunshine and being, you know, arguably biologically superior to the other poppies. And, you know, the tall poppy kind of gets cut down. You know, that's the sort of analogy here. You know, we people here, if you are striving and looking to better yourself and be better than other people in their perception or their narrative, then they want to sort of, you know, figuratively cut you down, you know, bring you back down to size, you know?
Yeah. In fact, I have a saying that I kind of like in exactly that vein, which is some people like to look taller by cutting off the heads of others.
Mm. Yeah. That's kind of it really. It's a real shame. I would never condone it. I can see why some people might feel like that if the taller poppies are not humble with it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I think we just need to be kind and humble and help the other poppies grow up to our level as well.
So how did your bosses or more, the senior doctors, you tell us, how did the bullying manifest itself in your circumstance?
So, I mean, you know, when I talk about types of workplace bullying, there's the sort of general types that are, you know, can occur in the workplace or occur elsewhere. And these can be overt, you know, really, really sort of obvious in your face, you know, like the kind of classic schoolyard physical bullying. But, you know, there can be, you know, something that is potentially seen by other people, public criticism, shaming, berating, belittling, that kind of thing, ostracizing people. And then there's the sort of all the forms of discrimination and harassment. You know, they're all really types of bullying, you know, discrimination on the grounds of your gender, your racial origin, your belief system, your sexuality, that kind of thing, you know. And then there's the more covert types of bullying, those that aren't necessarily seen by other people. So it may be noticed by other people, but things like passive aggression, gaslighting, these terms I don't particularly agree with, having spoken to lots of often African American friends and people who've been on my podcast, but casual racism.
Yeah.
You know, arguably there's nothing really casual about it. You
no.
know, if you're getting on a bus and you are electing not to sit next to a black person and you will walk past them to go and sit next to a white person or sit on your own, to me there's nothing casual about that. It's very, very intentional, you know.
Sure. If I may, but out of all those litany of things that can happen to you, you were a doctor, and I would think doctor status. So how did it happen to you? In fact, I remember in researching your background before the interview, you had a quote of something to the effect of, as you were thinking about work over a weekend, you said to yourself, what fresh hell would the perpetrators unleash on me when I was next at work? So tell us a little bit about what happened there. Who was doing it?
Yeah.
How did they do it?
Yeah. No. Well, you know, as to the types, a lot of the workplace bullying in medicine, because it's, you know, administered, if you like, by not particularly emotionally intelligent people. Because let's, you know, if you think about this, this was for me, it was in the early to mid noughties, you know, sort of between 2000 and 2010, really. I graduated from med school in 2000. You know, that generation of senior doctor, they didn't know much about emotional intelligence. You know, they didn't know how to regulate their tempers, you know, and they just, you know, they lost it in front of people on the wards, you know. So there would be like some of those overt forms of bullying I talked about, you know, where I wasn't ever struck by anyone, but, you know, I was absolutely publicly criticized, shamed, berated, belittled, you know. And, you know, that would happen. That was just normal. It was just accepted as part of the culture that, you know, you're just going to be put down and told off, you know, like a child, really. But in the, you know, the severest possible way, or you were going to be, how can I put it? Hold on, Andy. I'm just having a little bit of a blank. What I was going to say. Shall I pause for a sec?
Yeah, sure. But yeah. I can just ask you another question. That's fine. In terms of what the doctors were doing, they were berating you. They were humiliating you.
Yeah.
You felt shame. And how did you deal with it? How did you respond to it? Did you just try to work harder?
The thing is, when you, as a doctor, you know, you're held to such a high degree of professionalism, you know, it's you know, in a way, this the hypocrisy of the system, that these people who are treating you like this are almost allowed or sanctioned to behave in the most unprofessional of ways, but you as the target on the receiving end, you have to, you know, maintain your composure, and you can't shout back at them. I mean, there are myriad reasons for that, including the fact that, you know, biting the hand that feeds you, you know, are you going to shout back at someone who's responsible for writing your reference, you know,
and writing your checks in a way and signing the checks. I mean, maybe not literally, but those are the people, they have all the leverage. You know, I was in television production and still am, but for 25 years here in New York, and I loved the work. I'm sure you loved being in medicine. You worked so hard to get there. And you don't want to just let the bully win. At least in my case, I loved the work. I loved following the news and communicating the news to the world. And I thought I just need to, and to be gendered about it. I say this often. I don't mean it quite this way, but, you know, man up, right? Like, I'm supposed to be tougher. But to your point, I didn't feel like I had the leverage to speak my mind, because I thought that I'd lose my job, lose my income, which I needed, lose my job, which I had worked so hard to get. So I certainly understand that feeling. So what effect did all this bullying have on you? Here you are. It's hard enough being a young doctor, but what effect did it have on your emotional, psychological, and physical well-being?
Yeah. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. There's a huge power imbalance.
Yeah.
And so you can't really react or respond to it.
In those days as a junior doctor, you know, it just never even entered my mind. And I'm sure it's the same for my colleagues, to raise a complaint about your boss, go to HR and tell them what had happened. You just wouldn't do that.
Nope.
And as I say, as a doctor, you are, from a professional perspective, put on a little bit of a pedestal. Yep. And there's a certain amount, not so much these days, a certain amount of deference towards you for, as you say, your academic achievements of getting through medical school and so on. And, you know, everything has to be perfect. I mean, medicine is full of perfectionists, and it's really drummed into you at medical school that you can't make any mistakes. You know, you can't show any weakness. You know, you can't have an Achilles heel. You can't have a chink in your armor. So you just have to sort of, you know, grin and bear it, really. Just take the tirade of abuse and just, you know, smile with grace and then go, you know, go off the ward as soon as they finished, as soon as it's safe to do so from a patient perspective, whatever, and just cry in your doctor's office or whatever, or go back to your accommodation and have a cry or hold it all in because the day's so busy that you wait until you get home and you just have, you know, cry about it then. And you can't really, I mean, I would speak to my family about it, but you can't really speak to your colleagues about it because, again, you know, they're all trying to maintain this front of perfectionism. And you can't let them know that you have any weaknesses, you know? So
yeah, I was, when it happened to me, I was a boss myself. I mean, I was an executive producer.
Yeah.
And I most often reported to either the CEO or the number two in the whole company or the network, the media company I was working for.
Yeah.
And so one, I was trying to shield my staff from it. So I was absorbing all of it.
Mm.
And I also didn't want anyone to know that it was getting to me. And so I'd go home and you are alone. As much as I had a supportive family for much of it, a very supportive wife, you know, we've been married over 20 years, but you're still alone because nobody can help you if you're that circumstance.
Yeah.
So for me, I had digestive problems, terrible anxiety, hypervigilance. Yeah. And I did have, and it's hard for me even to say it to this day, suicidal ideation. I was one that was going to act on it, but I was ruminating. And did you experience some of those types of things?
So I think it's a bit like that that adage. I think it's originally a sort of a Chinese adage, but the death by a thousand cuts. You know?
Yeah.
So you just a constant. I mean, it was just how can I say it? It's probably had more effect on me later on, because honestly, it was just the norm in the culture. It was just accepted.
Yeah, same in television.
You know? Yeah, and you know, I mean, this is a bit of a British kind of pop culture reference, but there are these films from the 1950s or 1960s and later, I think, as well, called, the first one was called Doctor in the House, and they were with an actor called Leslie Phillips, and there was this, when they were medical students, there's a scene where they're around the bedside of a patient and the consultant surgeon, who's like an absolute dinosaur, but he's also like a huge guy, absolutely huge guy.
Yeah.
And his name is Sir Lancelot Spratt.
Okay.
Right. And you know, if it wasn't so awful, it would be very, very comedic, but it absolutely, you know, just abject humiliation of these students and these junior doctors. And that's just the way it was. You know, it's what we called teaching by ritual humiliation.
Yeah. Almost like in this country, I don't know if you know, fraternity hazing on college campuses. Yeah. It's just part of the culture.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, I mean, it's amazing that this can still go on. And we're talking about healthcare, which I understand, and you're the expert. And I want to get into the work you're doing to help others because you've been through it. And now that's what you're doing in just wonderful ways. But you, it happens in healthcare. I hear a lot, education. Yeah. I talk to all kinds of people in nonprofits. You think in nonprofits, people would be kind to one another, you know, because their whole job is to help others, and yet they end up bullying each other. I mean, it happens to our television, media, you name it. But yeah. You sent me an amazing video, and then we'll move on from beyond medicine and doctors. But you sent me an amazing video. It was kind of a panel discussion with several doctors.
Yeah.
Who were talking about their experience, as you have.
Yeah.
And the first doctor was a young female doctor in this case. And as she was talking about the effect of the bullying and the berating, and again, you acknowledge it, you said it before, and in my case too, nobody ever threw a stapler at my head. I'm not gushing blood. I'm not a Me Too victim. So we understand this is the incivility in the workplace, workplace aggression, psychological harassment. But she burst into tears talking about it. And again, to your point, I don't think most people have any idea. We look at people like you and with status. And so let me ask this. You work with other doctors now in counseling them. And then I'd also like to hear about the other types of people. What kind of stories are you hearing from the people that are coming to you in your work?
So I think I just want to speak to your earlier point first, if that's okay, for a wee bit of background.
Yep.
But, you know, I think for me, it was a cumulative effect. So I would just, as you said, kind of ruminate, you know, I would go away and I would think about it and I would rationalize it and I would, you know, normalize it and, you know, just say, well, I'm dependent on this person to get my next job. So I just have to toe the party line and let them treat me how they want to. And there's, you know, this kind of delayed gratification, you know, when I'm in my next job, it'll be better. When I'm a more senior doctor, it'll be better and whatever. But actually, over the years of experiencing, you know, in surgical jobs, primarily, you know, regular repeated forms of overt bullying and just constant criticism. The thing you got to remember in medicine is that, and I work with doctors all over the world, and it's the same all over, is that you very, very seldom get praised for doing a good job. You know, it's never going to be, that was really good that you decided just to do those extra bloods because you picked up this, you know, deteriorating renal function that actually means we can't prescribe that medication. You might have saved that person's life. Well done, you know, job well done. It's 99% just negative. So that is going to get to you. And for me, it was over the years where I started to, and I think the manifestation of it for me was with burnout. I think the workplace bullying frequency of exposure led me to burnout, and there were other reasons for the burnout as well. In terms of the things that other people say, absolutely. I mean, you know, you've got from the sort of acute side, things that you've described where people actually have suicidal thoughts, you know, or get depressed. But the thing about doctors and depression and doctors and anxiety is they have what we call high functioning anxiety or high functioning depression. So they know all the signs and symptoms. They can hide it. And often what happens is, you know, and, you know, we're recording this on the 11th of September, and yesterday was World Suicide Prevention Day.
Mm-hmm.
And 300 to 400 physicians die by suicide every year in the US alone.
Yeah.
That's one a day.
Yeah. One of my best friends of my whole life.
Took
his own life. He was in emergency room because he couldn't let on that he was having real difficulty. Yeah. So I know this is new.
So they hide it, they keep it in. And then the first you hear about it is, oh my goodness, the absolutely shocking news that you find out that a colleague has died by suicide. You know, so that happens. Obviously, those that don't get to that kind of awful level, that tragic level, you know, will still have PTSD and flashbacks and kind of chronic depression. And also, you know, there's that mental health side of things for sure. But, you know, there's all the other kind of, I don't want to call it, I don't like this term, you know, kind of like the softer side of things, like just having your confidence knocked all of the time is going to reduce your self-esteem. It's going to lead to imposter phenomenon. You're going to not be an assertive person in the workplace. You're going to be conflict averse, you know, you know, all of these things that actually will hold you back in your career are manifestations of it as well.
Well, you know, in my world, I was in the world of communications. I'm in the world of mass media and communications. Yeah. And one of the worst things, take away the issue, psychological and emotional, for the target in the workplace, what ends up happening is you have a chilling effect where people don't talk to each other. They don't present ideas. They're scared to talk. And can you, I can only imagine that's bad enough in the news business, the sports business, which was it I was in. I can't imagine what it's like when doctors aren't communicating, especially with the senior doctors, because they're scared about the response they're going to get.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Now you're talking about people's lives at stake. Then, you know, not talking about a news story that might not be written as well or something. But so in your practice, because I'm curious what you're doing and how you're counseling the people that you're meeting with, organizations or individuals. I read that you use stress management techniques and mind shifts to build confidence, because you said, you know, we lose our self-esteem.
Yeah.
We lose our confidence, we lose our dignity. So in your practice, how are you addressing those issues for people that are targets of bullying and under extreme stress and trauma?
Yeah, so I think it's important to say that, you know, there are these approaches for the individual, and they, you know, you have to kind of implement these and utilize these. But at the same time, that is great and it's helping one person at a time. But there has to be a sort of organizational systemic approach as well. You know, I kind of call it a top down and a bottom up approach, both simultaneously, because, you know, you may well be equipping one person with some skills to cope in the future. And let's not forget, these are ultimately very, very resilient people, you know, to get through high school, to get the GPA they need to get into medical school, to get through medical school and internship and residency. These are super, super, super resilient people. So when, you know, when they are broken, you know, they have experienced it, or they've been on the receiving end of a lot of stuff. So, you know, we've got to kind of amalgamate those two approaches. But yeah, I mean, there's the stuff of teaching them how to deal with stuff at the time.
Yeah.
You know, so if it happens to them again, how can they de-escalate situations? How can they depersonalize situations? How can they distract? How can they utilize other people in the group? You know, when the situations that I've had, sometimes there've been upwards of 12, 15 other people around where I have been absolutely screamed at by someone, including patients. It's happening for patients. Massive levels of unprofessionalism there from the leaders there. But, you know, try and bring other people in to kind of cause a distraction. And, you know, then ultimately, as I said, with physicians and a lot of other professionals like lawyers will be the same, that it's very hard for them to admit to themselves that they'll see it as a weakness. They'll perceive it as a weakness. Yeah. So admitting to yourself that you're being bullied, accepting it, you can't move forward with anything unless you have acceptance. You know this from your own experience.
Sure.
And I think the thing that I started doing about 4 years ago, just under 4 years ago, was I may have been one of the first physicians to kind of go on record and just give my story openly and authentically.
Yeah.
And we just need, you know, we need more people to do that, because most people are not hearing my voice or coming across my content. So we need more and more and more people to talk about it openly, so that the other people who are targets know they're not alone, and they know that it's not their fault, you know?
That's been the impetus for me to get into this work. I just want to add my voice to those of you who have been fighting the good fight for a while. I want to get back to one thing, because you've given up medicine to help other people through this issue.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how bad the bullying was for you. And you spent so much time, obviously, and now you're using your medical degree and your law degree to help others in those circumstances who've been bullied. So let me ask this. You talked about top down. In my experience, I never saw any of my bullies become contrite. I didn't see self-awareness. Now, of course, they didn't come across you. They didn't seek any kind of help. And me trying to get them help was, like you said, there was nobody to go to. So let me ask, in your work with organizations and working top down, are you seeing any bullies who go, oh gosh, I didn't realize the impact that was having? I mean, is that even possible?
Yes, it is possible, because not every, you know, so-called bully or someone who's perceived to be a bully is an absolute aggressor, a narcissist, you know, a kind of an evil person. Some of them are, you know, what you might call accidental bullies, you know, as in they don't have the self-awareness, the insight to realize how they're hurting other people, you know? And so they, you know, we know that hurt people. And, you know, and to give them some sort of equity in this situation, you know, it's all learned behavior. You know, if they're of a different generation, they have seen their bosses just do that to them.
Yep.
And other people around them. So that they model themselves on that, thinking that's the right way to be, because there's no leadership training at medical school.
Right.
So,
I don't think business schools either. Yeah. You know, we're talking about, I mean, the kind of bullying we're talking about, it's astounding that it's happening to doctors, but it's happening to people. And ultimately, it doesn't matter. Like, I moved up from senior producer, executive producer, vice president of programming. And like you said, when I'm a senior doctor, it doesn't matter what your title is. In my view, it doesn't matter how you're compensated particularly, because want that affirmation. Like you said, you want that, wow, you did an unbelievable job caring for that patient. Yeah. That was, you know, we all want to feel good about our devotion, our loyalty, and our commitment to the work. And that's where, when we're getting bullying, I think it's so very, very painful.
Yeah, yeah. No, so no, I 100% agree. So, you know, I think that, you know, they're not all malignant individuals. Some of them are hurting, and they haven't processed, you know, past hurt, childhood trauma. You know, some of them are insecure people. You know, they'll see you as a threat because you're really good at your job, for example, and it's quite possible that you know more than them, you know, and they feel threatened by that. But I think for me, the crux of it is that those situations, notwithstanding, if they had good emotional intelligence, they wouldn't bully, you know, but they are lacking self-awareness. They're lacking emotional regulation, the ability to regulate their emotions, you know?
Yeah. And I think those of us that are targeted, like, I didn't have the emotional intelligence to figure out how to fight it, how to figure out a political battle, how to maneuver, and so all I did was say, I just need to work harder and better and get more views for my TV shows or make more money for the company. And it never worked.
You know, the insight to realize that it wasn't personal.
Yeah.
It wasn't about you. And so, you know, then when you realize that, when you have that light bulb moment, you can be like, okay, this is why they're doing it, because they've got a shit marriage or they are being disciplined at work for something else, or, you know, they're killing patients accidentally because they're terrible surgeons, and you know, whatever the reason is, you can then rationalize it if you have that self-awareness. But the good news is that emotional intelligence can be learned and developed and worked on, and it is a skill. It's a muscle like any other skill. You can work on it and make it bigger, so you can help those people. And that, you know, is obviously part of the organizational approach. But a lot of it, really, for me, I mean, we didn't get the chance to talk much about the individuals and how to help them. But in terms of organizations, it's really about the culture, isn't it? It's really about the values in an organization. And this comes from the top down.
Yep.
And organizational values have to be genuine. They can't just be, these are our values on our website, but actually on the shop floor, this is what's going on. You know, there has to be absolute alignment between what they're publicizing their values as being and what they really are. And they need to bring people into senior positions who are in alignment with those good values to develop and promote positive cultures, you know. And we need more compassion in the workplace. You know, we need compassionate leadership, servant leadership, inclusive leadership. You know, we need workplaces where, you know, we almost have like a United Nations right to be happy at work, you know, for that to be, for it, that, you know, I mean, that may be, you know, a bit twee, but
no, I agree.
Like, at the least, it has to be normalized that we have a right to go through our day without being, you know, kind of
abused,
treated in a rude, you know, uncivil way, you know.
Especially, I mean, it's one thing if you show up to work drunk, you show up late, you don't do your work, but we're talking about really good employees here. So
yeah,
we have a couple minutes remaining, and I want to ask you this, because you're one of the leading worldwide voices in this arena. And so that's why I'm so pleased to talk with you and so appreciative of the work you're doing. What do you think is the current circumstance around the world in terms of workplace incivility? Is it worsening? You're in New Zealand. I'm in the United States. It still seems to be an epidemic to me, but you've got a world view. What's your sense of where we're going with this issue?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm British, and I live, you know, kind of 48 years of my life or whatever in the UK. We only moved to New Zealand 8 months ago. But I've lived in Australia as well, and I've worked with an awful lot of American physicians and some Canadians as well. So I can only really speak with authority about the sort of English speaking countries.
Okay.
I mean, I do have some contacts in Europe and Asia, there are cultural nuances, but it is, I think, the pandemic really shone a light on it. And I think by the time, you know, we were all kind of starting to get hassle for, you know, working from home and being bullied remotely and all of this, I think a lot of people were saying enough is enough. So I think more people seem to be willing to speak about it. There is a movement, I would say, you know, and I think that's really in no small part been sort of championed by Linda Crockett, who founded the Canadian Institute of Workplace Violence and Harassment.
Yep. Linda's taking part in this summit. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, Gary and Ruth Namey, you know, created the Workplace Bullying Institute in the USA. So that's the preeminent place.
Yep. They're terrific. You know,
but I mean, Linda has really kind of created this network of us from all around the world.
Yep.
And you know, and I don't know whether the data shows that things are getting worse, or whether it's just more people feel more comfortable about speaking up now.
Yeah,
is probably what it is. I think it's always been pretty horrendous.
Yeah,
I think the pandemic made it worse, but
the
flip side is that, you know, now the conversations are beginning to happen, and you know, someone like yourself. Maybe wouldn't have done this 5 years ago.
Not a chance. I mean,
but now you feel, you know, comfortable doing it.
Well, I would just amend that and say I'm a little uncomfortable, but people like you who are making me feel more comfortable that I can share this story. I'm still dealing with my shame, a little bit of anger still, trying to figure it all out. But because of people like you, I want to add my voice and see what I can do to help this movement. So, Dr. Adam Harrison, I want to thank you so much for what an engaging and informative conversation, and for all the great work you're doing. And for those people watching and listening to this, how can people contact you for more of the advice and counsel that you've shared with us today?
Yeah, no, thank you. Thanks, Andy. And you know, I'm happy to kind of go into more detail in how I help people if they want to approach me directly. My email address is just dr.adamharrison@gmail.com. So dr.adamharrison@gmail.com, all lowercase. My website is www.dradamharrison. It looks like Dradam Harrison, someone said to me once. there's no full stops in there.
Yeah.
I'm on LinkedIn as Dr. Adam Harrison. And my podcast is really championing female leaders, because throughout my career, I felt, although there were some good male bosses that I had, And there were a handful of bad female bosses that I had on the whole. And in the main, my female leaders were more enlightened, shall we say, and kinder and more inspiring. So my podcast is called Inspiring Women Leaders. And we talk a lot about the things that I think are important, you know, compassionate leadership, servant leadership, inclusive leadership, and kindness in the workplace, and you know, the benefits, the far-reaching benefits of kindness to individuals, to teams, to bosses, to the organization as a whole, to shareholders, to third-party stakeholders. There's, you know, it's just a ripple effect. It's a gift that keeps on giving. You know, and to me, you know, kindness in the workplace and civility in the workplace plays a big part in being the antidote to these toxic cultures.
Yep. Toxic cultures are counterproductive in every way. Final word from me, we call ourselves bully targets, but now let's aim to change the workplace for good. Thanks for watching.